Paranormal Para X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Shall call. Live you must, and let to live. Fairly take, and fairly give. Do what thou will, if it harms none. By the magic of all, may it be done. Nine woods in the cauldron go, as above, so below. Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron on the Para X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, Merry Meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. The music you were just listening to is called Unseen Eyes by Midnight Syndicate with Destiny Beer doing vocals, and it's off their album called Vampire. And that works out really well tonight because vampires are the topic, and my guest is AP Sylvia. Now, Adam has had a long interest in supernatural beliefs and their origins, and beyond just immersing himself in the essential texts of vampire folklore, he's traveled to a number of vampire-related locations. He's the member, a member of the Northern American chapter of the Transylvania Society of Dracula, as well as the London-based Dracula Society, and he's here to talk about his new book, Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. And as always, if any of you have any questions or comments for Adam, and you're in the Para X chat room, send me a private message. And if you're not in chat and you have a burning question, you'll have to come over and join us at paraxradionetwork.com. Adam, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I had to wear a turtleneck tonight. I was kind of thinking about vampires. just protection, you know. You never know. Over the phone, technology could happen. But I was really impressed when I received the book, because without even opening it, it drew me right in. I mean, you know, the black hardback book, gold gothic font, shiny skull, crucifix, human heart, love it. and inside too, really, really interesting with lovely artwork, and the art department really at Schiffer really did a great job. Now, your bio says that you're a fan of classic monster movies, but are vampires your favorite monsters? And where did you get your interest? Where did that come into play? And what did Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in New York have anything to do with?
Sure.
I go you three in a row, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested in a lot of different sort of legends and folkloric beliefs, and vampires certainly, I guess since I've written a book about them, they must be my favorite. Classic monster movies, there's certainly a number of them featuring vampires in various ways. Probably most notable would be the classic Universal Dracula starring Bela Lugosi. That's a wonderful film. Yeah. What started me, started my interest in it? It's interesting. I was clearing out some old books of mine at my parents' not long ago, And I ran across a book about ghosts that my mom purchased for me when I was a little kid at like a children's museum. And it had all these different legends about ghosts and talked about supernatural stuff. And I remember just devouring that book, and I thought it was so cool. And that, has always been something that's sort of been with me, the interest in, supernatural beliefs and things of that nature. Getting to Ripley's, believe it or not, I'm not sure if you've ever been to one of their, one of their locations.
Yeah, I'm in LA, Hollywood. So yeah.
Oh yeah. I've been to that one. That's great. Mm-hmm. They're packed with all kinds of oddities and things like that. Yeah. And they're great. They're so much fun.
Yeah.
So some years ago now, I was in New York City in Times Square with my girlfriend, who's now my fiance, and we were walking around and looking for something to do and seeing what's going on, all the sights, and we happened upon a Ripley's, and I'm like, we must go in. so we're walking through it and checking everything out. And one of the objects they had on display was labeled as a 19th century vampire killing kit. Mm. And it was filled with different vials and vials for potions and holy water and steak. And there was a pistol in it with a mold for making silver bullets. And I remember that I thought the piece was fantastic, and it kind of was said that, oh, well, these were made for people who were, traveling to Eastern Europe and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was great. It was such an amazing, amazing piece, really kind of evocative of all of these vampire things. And so sometime later, I was thinking about that, and I was like, I'd like to learn more about these kits. What's the story with them? And so I took to the internet, as one does. And I actually found that there was some controversy about these kits. There's a number of them around. Ripley's has a lot, but they're in other museums as well. And while some folks, Ripley's included, maintain that they're authentic, there are others who feel that that they're actually 20th century pieces that were sort of constructed from 19th century parts. And one of the arguments is that, oh, well, the stuff in the kits reflects modern beliefs about vampires, movie vampires, and doesn't reflect, what people actually believed. Mm-hmm. And that sort of set me on a course of like, well, what did people actually believe? I had seen some different documentaries about, well, this was about vampires and stuff like that. And I was like, well, what about all these things that we all think of with vampires? And I started, looking for, maybe an article or a list or a book or something that sort of kind of described sort of piece by piece in detail kind of what the true folkloric beliefs were, contrasted with modern notions. And I couldn't find anything that kind of that quite answered my question in the way I wanted. So I ended up researching it and then writing the book that I wanted to read. Sometime later, we have Vampires of Lore.
So why do you think people are so interested in or attracted to the notion of vampires?
Well, I think they speak to us on kind of a fundamental level, and I think they fill a need depending on the time and the place. When you look at, the past, say the 1700s, something like that, vampires were used to explain things that people didn't understand and had no control over. So they were kind of scapegoats in a sense. There's a rash of mysterious deaths. People are looking for an explanation. Vampires. These days, we benefit from all of the scientific knowledge that's been developed since then. So we don't need vampires to explain away mysterious illnesses and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they've sort of shifted, and now there's this sort of alluring quality to them, and probably one of the most, important or things that people respond to the most, I think, is probably the the immortality of vampires. That's often kind of played up, and some people want to be, you know, in TV shows or movies, people want to become vampires because they'll be immortal and that kind of thing. And, you know, maybe that speaks to our fears nowadays of our mortality, because that's something that science has yet to conquer. So they're sort of evolving and adapting to sort of speak to us where we are and kind of fill whatever need it happens to be. And so I think that's kind of why they've endured. But at the same time, you know, with that more immortality, it comes at a price, right? Well, now they're cursed because of it. And perhaps that is sort of representative that, you know, it's nature can't be circumvented. And there's a price to going against it.
Exactly. And, you know, we're talking about the difference between the Hollywood vampires and the folklore. I mean, to gather that information, you had to learn to discern the difference between both. Was that kind of difficult, or after you got started, were you kind of easily able to separate the two?
It was difficult at first, because as if you read things that are modern, maybe someone writes an article on the internet or something like that, or some kind of modern work, people, knowingly or not, can actually be influenced by pop culture, and they will interpret old stories in different ways. So sometimes I would read this vampire account and I'd be like, look, it's this old account has all these things in it that we would associate with modern vampires. Oh, isn't that interesting? And then I would go back to an earlier telling of it, and suddenly all of these details, well, they're not there anymore, or they're presented in a different way or something like that. So that was I found that interesting. And so in my book, you know, I try to, when I could, I tried to find, go for pre-20th century sources as far back as I kind of could, and, you know, try to go to the earlier tellings before there was so much, you know, vampire pop culture stuff, and try to get to the, you know, as close to the original accounts and records as I could. Sometimes I could do that, sometimes I couldn't. If I you know, if I was using a more modern source, I tried to be very judicious in the sources I was using. So that was a very interesting thing that I noticed, how you know, your modern preconceptions about something can very much influence how you interpret something and how you retell it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because you don't have that mindset that came before. You know, we only have our own. Excuse me. So yeah, it's kind of it's fun, but you must have really kind of done the roller coaster thing. Trying to go, okay, well, this is that. Well, maybe not up and down until you finally found that happy medium.
Oh, yeah. It was interesting. And the other thing that kind of emerges with that is, you know, these days we have very concrete notions about, well, this is what a vampire is and this is what it does. Mm-hmm. But when you go back in time, these are folkloric beliefs. You know, supernatural beliefs. So they could differ and change from place to place. You know, the way a vampire behaved in one region was not the way it was thought to behave in another region. So that was something interesting too. There was a lot more nuance to things, a lot more variation, where now it's been refined and sort of brought into sort of this one cohesive image. And obviously you watch a movie where they'll change something, but it's sort of known that they're changing something. And sometimes it's even acknowledged that, oh, well, vampires actually don't respond to XYZ. but, you know, when you go back to the actual beliefs, they would differ. So that actually made finding things challenging as well, because some place might believe something and then another place might have a variation of it. So I tried to bring those different beliefs into the book and sort of talk about, well, here in this case, I found an example of this, while over here, I found an example of this.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about some of those examples as we go along. But what is the true definition of a vampire?
Well, that's very interesting. And, you'll get a different answer depending on who you ask.
It's very subjective, huh?
it very much is. There are some works out there that are like that will talk about vampire beliefs from different places and times, and some authors or writers will cast a very wide net, and any kind of supernatural monster that drinks blood or something like that is a vampire by their definition. For me, that was not how I approached them, because I feel that when you bring in too many different beliefs, it obscures kind of the core of what I felt the root of the vampire beliefs was. So I kind of lay out in my book that I sort of used three criteria in terms of figuring out, like, well, does this constitute a vampire belief or not? And so for me, the first one was, it has to be a reanimated corpse. So it has to be a thing that once was a human being and was somebody's neighbor, right? There's some folks that will work in like, oh, well, these were, it's not a demon or some kind of supernatural creature that was always a supernatural creature, right? Mm-hmm. For me, vampires had to at one point have been human and they passed away and now they are the dead coming back from the grave. Because to me, that was an important point about vampires, is that it was a fear of the dead and what the dead could do to you. Mm-hmm. The second criteria for me was that the corpse was harming the living in some way, right? So they were mm-hmm. detrimental to the living. That includes blood drinking, but for me, it doesn't. That's not all of it. If you look at some of the vampire beliefs, vampires were doing other things actually besides drinking blood, mm-hmm. which might surprise some folks. There's sort of a range of actions it could do, and lastly. To destroy the vampire, some action had to be taken against the corpse itself. So there's a physical nature to the vampire. You know, it's not this sort of ephemeral spirit or something like that. There's a physicality to it that I also felt was quite important. So that was sort of my criteria, and I tried to stick with that throughout the book. I would deviate from time to time if needed, if I felt that it was relevant to do so. But that was kind of my guiding principle. And I think that kind of worked out well and sort of kept it focused and really sort of brought into clearer focus what the vampire beliefs were all about.
Mm-hmm. What's a half vampire? Because, I mean, as long as we're talking about vampires, there is in the book talk of a half vampire.
Yes, that was something I found very interesting. I remember a long time ago, I was looking that up. That always, you know, and there's some works out there that have these half vampires that go out and hunt full-blooded vampires and stuff like that. And that always sort of struck me as like, is this some kind of Hollywood invention? You know, you had to create sort of a sympathetic but super-powered, interesting hero that was going to fight the vampires but could stand up to them. Like, oh, a half vampire, okay. So it always had this sort of ring of like, this seems invented to me. And in my research, I was surprised to learn that it was actually an actual folkloric belief that that there were in some places people believed that vampires could have natural born offspring, those offspring then were thought to have strengths or abilities that allowed them to sort of exorcise vampires from villages and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So they would be sought out if a village thought that they had some kind of vampire problem. And the other interesting thing is that they could actually be descendants of the vampire. So they could actually be multiple generations removed from whatever ancestor was believed to be a vampire, but they were thought to still have that vampire fighting ability. That was something that I thought I was sort of pleasantly surprised by, and I thought it added a very sort of unique element to things.
Well, I was surprised by a few things and, you know, disappointed.
Oh, yeah.
Here it comes, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, this is how it had. I didn't go looking for that. But when I first got the book, I flipped it open and flipped through the various chapters. And you know, things jump out at you. And, of course, the chapter on fangs jumped out on me. Don't ask me why. But I was surprised to read that in tradition, vampire beliefs do not incorporate fangs. And so then, you know, the mind starts going on. Well, if there are fangless vampires, then what else made them so fearsome if they didn't suck blood?
So yeah, the fangs, the fangs thing, I'm sure a lot of people would be surprised about. And that's probably one of the most, that's definitely one that, is quite, quite unexpected given, how strong fangs are in our current vampire imagery, right? If you're watching a TV show, and you know, some actor looks menacingly at the camera, smiles, and they've got two, elongated canine teeth, you immediately know they're a vampire, right? Uh-huh. That's all you need. And that's it. So there, but yeah, there was really nothing in the folklore that talked about vampires having, fangs, elongated canine teeth in that way. They were believed to suck blood, or at least in some accounts they were. And that often wasn't really explained anyway. They sort of just did. It wasn't talked about like, well, they needed fangs or they did that. In some
slit
accounts,
his throats, yes.
Yeah. I mean, in some accounts, it was just sort of taken as a given. The vampire sucked their blood, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The probably one of the things that made people believe that is when they exhumed some of these corpses that they thought were vampires terrorizing them. They would see blood around the mouth of the corpse. Mm-hmm. And that is actually that is actually something that can happen naturally in the decomposition process.
Right.
But they probably saw that and then jumped to the conclusion, well, people are ill. We've exhumed this body, this person who we think started it all, and there's blood around their mouth. What else could it be?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of one thing. There, to kind of explore some of the variations in vampirism that you come across. For instance, there was one belief that that they thought that the vampire had like a barb at the end of its tongue, sort of mm-hmm. like a stinger or something like that. So it mm-hmm. would it could get you that way. And there are some accounts where there is a wound on the neck, but it's not two wounds. Right, mm-hmm. it's not the two fang marks. There are accounts mm-hmm. of a single wound. But again, that's where you need to be careful. Where there's wounds on the neck. That must be the fang marks, right? Like you can't go there, but you're sort of primed for it. So there's some of that. There's beliefs where the vampire would suck the blood from the chest, for the heart or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of interesting how it could change from place to place.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we're talking about maybe misconceptions or whatever, but, so there's a question in the chat room since we blew the fang thing. they want to know, what about the garlic and their reflections? Do those hold true?
Yeah, garlic. Absolutely. Garlic was believed to be able to repel vampires. People would use it. They would rub it around the entrances to their house and that kind of thing. Yeah, garlic, absolutely. Mirrors. There is some vampire lore around mirrors, but not the lack of reflection. That was not a belief that people had, that a vampire did not cast a reflection in a mirror. And when you think about if you think about it from a practical term, it's actually not that surprising they didn't believe it, because remember, a lot of this, people were actually digging up corpses in some of these accounts, right? They actually mm-hmm. they thought this was happening. They went to the graveyard and they dug somebody up. So they could have taken a mirror and held it up to that person. And, you know, it's just never met. The lack of reflection is never mentioned in the folklore.
Well, you know, the mirror thing too could be when, you know, they were checking people to see if they were dead, they would always stick it under their nose to see if, you know, whatever. So maybe there is something to do with that, that they just kind of threw in the misconception kind of thing or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of that kind of can be worked into, you know, from a literary sense or something like that. The mirror being, you know, a reflection of the soul. Mm-hmm. There were beliefs about, you know, covering mirrors because, mm-hmm. you know, after a death, because, you know, if you looked in the mirror, the person's soul, the soul might see you and then it will stay or something like that. Mm-hmm. So in literature with vampires, not casting a reflection, that could be used to imply that they were soulless. Mm-hmm. So there you kind of have, folkloric beliefs influencing fiction and fiction sort of evolving that belief.
Mm, that makes good sense. Right before we go to break, I guess I'll ask you the personal question about what you believe the greatest misconceptions about vampires are. Maybe there's one, maybe there's more. But everybody has this, as you said, in their head, what a vampire is to them. And they believe it. So what do you find is the greatest misconception?
Well, I perhaps the greatest misconception is that there are these sort of hard and fast rules that a vampire must do X, Y, Z. Vampires, they were a folkloric belief that evolved over time in different places. And there's a lot of nuance and a lot of variation there. I think you can't walk in thinking that it's always going to be one way.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, no two witches are alike, for example. You know, everybody, and I'm sure all these other fictional things, I mean, no two mermaids are alike, whatever. Everybody changes. I mean, no two human beings are exactly alike. So I guess it makes good sense that they would not be all the same. And again, depending on region and belief systems and folklore, yeah, that kind of is the way it could work very easily. But it's still so fascinating. I mean, because there's so many variants in it. And I mean, you must have had a field day doing all the research and you couldn't obviously put it all into one book. Were there things that you really thought you would want to put in, but you didn't have enough room or whatever? Or
yeah, I wanted the book to move at a good pace. I didn't want to bog it down. I didn't want to sort of overwhelm. I was looking to answer questions with it. You know, there's a lot of stories. Sometimes I had to sort of pick and choose, or sort of do an amalgamation of different things. You know, so yeah, there were definitely moments where I kind of had to, you know, edit things out or be like, well, I'll focus on this one and not that one, or tell it in a certain way. So again, because I was sort of trying to answer questions with the book. So you sort of talk about, you answer a question a different way than if you were just telling stories or something like that.
Did you have to be kind of non-judgmental? I mean, did you have to be walking the straight line and not going either way to the fictional things as opposed to the folkloric things? I mean, totally impartial to write this book in correctly?
Yeah, I think it was, it's important to know that all of it plays a part in what our conceptions are about vampires. And, you know, I suppose people could be sad that, oh, well, fangs aren't in folklore. That's okay that they're not in folklore. They're in our fiction now. And you know, they were introduced in like the mid 1800s. Well, that's when the first kind of vampire had fangs. But they're a part of it now, and vampires are growing and evolving and changing, and that's okay. That it's fun stuff. It's fun stuff to see kind of what the modern vampire is in movies and stuff like that.
Well, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
But I think, you know, I tried to I tried to go through the folklore, and I tried to one thing I do sort of, you know, try to get across is that, you know, the people who believe these things, who were experiencing things, they were trying to make sense of a world that they didn't understand. And this is how they did it. They did not have the benefit of our current understanding. So they were looking to deal with problems and give, you know, take control of something and try to save themselves and others. So they're interesting accounts, but they can be, it's also sometimes sad and poignant as to what had to be done when you think about someone who had to actually dig up a relative or something like that because they felt that they were in danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on that happy note, we're going to take a quick 2-minute break. So everybody stay put, and we'll be right back.
Don't go away. There's more Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks right after these important messages.
It's time to learn your real talents. Learn what to focus on. Then change your perspective. Regain those divine intentions. Be empowered by what life throws at you. They are Psychic Little T and Jennifer Green, Nashville's astrologer. Tune in and discover who you really are and set free your passions. Get comfortable with the uncomfortable. Then you can follow your passions with renewed energy. May your journey be one of divine wonder to get where you want to be. Come aboard. They are Jennifer Green, Nashville's astrologer, and Psychic Little T. Every Thursday night from 7 till 8 p.m. Eastern, right here on Para-X Radio.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle Deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from shifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
And it's Vampire Night on Stirring the Cauldron. We're back with Adam Sylvia, and we're talking about his new book, Vampires of Lore, Traits, and Modern Misconceptions. And so I was, you know, Adam, I was surprised to find out another thing in the book. I mean, I love learning things, and maybe this one I wasn't paying attention about, but I was surprised to find out that a vampire cannot enter a house without permission of somebody inside. So we really don't need to close our windows at night for fear a vampire will fly through the bedroom window in the form of a bat, because that's another misconception. And in Dracula, you said that Van Helsing clearly states that someone in the household needs to bid a vampire in. But maybe they left that part out in the movie version, or maybe I just wasn't paying attention. Was it in the movie version too?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. It's an interesting detail about it. It's been worked into some other. Fictional things from time to time. It comes in. I think it was like The Lost Boys. That's if you ever saw that movie, that's in that one, that you have to invite the vampire in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember if the Universal one makes a point of it or not. It's an interesting detail. It's always it always struck me as one that was why make it harder to write the script where you have to like work in this thing. But that's been in a few different things. Not really part of folklore. There were some things in folklore that were maybe leaning towards it, walking towards it, but ultimately it was introduced in fiction. And I think that it makes sense when you think about it from a folkloric aspect. If let's say there was some kind of disease or epidemic in a town or something like that, people would probably realize fairly quickly that no one was inviting anybody in, and yet people were still getting sick. But it's a detail that gets worked into some movies, and I think it's interesting to see how writers sort of tackle it.
Well, it totally blew my mind, because then I start thinking, this is scary, because, all right, so I don't know, I didn't see that you were writing about vampires being shapeshifters, but you know, obviously the bats are not part of folklore in general. But then I'm thinking, all right, we know about vampire bats. They suck blood. But where did they get the name vampire bats? You know, they must have had some other name before the vampire thing came into play.
Yeah, so that the link between vampires and bats today it's so strong, right? In all of our, especially like think of Halloween imagery or something like that. You'll have a kind of a cartoon vampire in his cape. He kind of holds it up like bat wings, and maybe he's got pointy ears and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Very much in sync there. Vampires turning into bats, practically unheard of in the folklore. There were a couple references to it that were recently discovered that I read about in a scholarly article, which was very interesting when I found it, because for the longest time people thought that like Stoker had invented it. Mm-hmm. But vampire bats, they are named for the monster, not the other way around. They're not native to Europe. They're native to Latin America. So Europeans only would have encountered them, discovered them, after voyages to the New World, and so they were named for the monster. So mm-hmm. And vampires, obviously have been around a lot longer than Europeans traveling the Atlantic.
You would hope so. Now you traveled to a lot of cemeteries that were connected with vampires. People buried there who supposedly were vampires. So in doing your homework beforehand, were you able to find the backstories on who these people were and maybe why they were accused of being vampires to begin with?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I visited a number of different sites. Probably the one that's most well known would be the grave of Mercy Brown in Exeter, Rhode Island. So people might be surprised to find out that there were cases of supposed vampires in the United States, in New England especially. So it's not just not confined to Transylvania or something like that. So yeah, the Mercy Brown incident that happened in the 1800s, and that was that one was well documented. It was written about in the newspaper at the mm-hmm. time, so there's a couple articles about it, so we know quite a bit about it because it was written about. But what happened in that case is that the family was suffering from tuberculosis, what they referred to then as consumption, mm-hmm. and a lot of the New England vampire cases, consumption was to blame. But the families would get sick. One person would get sick, pass away. Another person would get it, pass away. Another person, and so there was a belief that the first person who caught it would be causing the deaths of the others. And so that's in the case of Mercy Brown. Mercy, her mother and her other sister had passed away from it, and then her brother Edwin was sick and dying. And to in an attempt to save his life, they exhumed the bodies of the deceased family members, looking for signs of vampirism. And so when they looked at Mercy's body, who she had died recently, and she had died in the winter, so it was cold. Her body was well preserved, and they thought the heart had like fresh blood in it. So that to them was the signs of vampires. Mm-hmm. So to save Edwin's life, they took out the heart, and it might have also been a part of the liver, and they burned it on a nearby rock. They burned it to ashes, right? Mm-hmm. And then they took the ashes from the heart and they stirred it into water that they then gave to Edwin to drink.
Ugh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We hear this now, and it's quite shocking, but you can only imagine the desperation of these people.
Yeah.
The father had lost his wife, his two daughters, and now he's losing his son. And so Edwin was given this potion. But it did not work, and he eventually passed away as well. So I visited that grave. I visited the graves of some other supposed vampires. And I went to some other spots too. I went to Chicago. There was a vampire hunt in a park there, back in the day. I went to Philadelphia. I looked at Bram Stoker's original notes for Dracula. That was really cool. They were on display at a museum in Philadelphia. And even in England, I went to Highgate Cemetery. There was actually a vampire scare in the 1970s. There was kind of this kind of uproar about it. I didn't write about that in my book, but I did a blog post about it on my blog, locationsoflore.com, so people can read about that.
Yeah.
I'll also mention the whole notion of burning the heart to ashes and consuming the, mixing it into a drink, consuming it. That sounds like something sort of original. We most people haven't heard of that kind of thing. That was actually also a belief in Romania. Mm-hmm. I found accounts where people did that. People supposedly did that in Romania to save victims of vampires. So quite interesting how it made it halfway around the world.
Well, it is. And, the other interesting part too is, when you're in a cemetery, it's a sobering experience, but knowing what you know, there were so many various ways of burying people that they thought to be vampires, and to try to make sure that they were dead, or at the very least prevent them from crawling out of the graves. Did you find anything that was really creepy, weird about that, or something that I left out about what maybe some practices?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you'll read articles about archaeologists finding these sort of strange burials. They're called deviant burials, just because the burial practice, deviates from the norm. There's all sorts of, different things where, the body would be mutilated in some way or something like that. I think there was one in Connecticut where they found the skull was taken and put in the middle, and the femurs were crossed or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's stories of people who would bury the corpse upside down. So they would be facing down instead of up. So if they came back to life, they would go in the wrong direction. So
I like that. Very, it makes sense.
Yeah, people were they had all kinds of different ideas about it. I guess those particular vampires weren't too bright. But yeah, there was all sorts of things people would do, to try to pin, hold the corpse in or make it such that it couldn't get up and move around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody in chat wrote stone in the jaw. So they were doing that too, I guess.
Sure, yeah. That came from a belief where it was thought that the vampire or the corpse would be chewing in the grave, right? Mm. It would be chewing, would be eating its shroud or eating itself. And by virtue of it doing that through some kind of sympathetic magic, it would cause disease and death in family members and neighbors.
Ah.
So, for instance, in Germany, that particular vampire was known as a Nachtzuhrer, and there's other examples of it. So the idea was that you would stop it from chewing, and that would save everyone. So you could put a stone in it or a coin, or you would put something under its mouth so it couldn't open its mouth. And that was the approach for those. But again, you see that's we don't think about Dracula just lying in his coffin chewing on his sheets and causing trouble. But again, you have the case where it's an undead corpse that is reanimated in some fashion and causing harm to the living. So something physically had to be done to it to stop that. So if you look at the folklore, suddenly all these variations kind of come into play, and it's fascinating. And it stems from this fear of the dead that they will bring death to you.
Mm-hmm. Somebody in chat asked about the vampire wolf connection. That's probably going. It's been there a while when we were talking about bats. I just didn't see it. Is there a vampire wolf connection?
Yes, there is, and I actually. In my book, I actually have a chapter about the connection with witches and werewolves to vampires, and there's sort of there's a lot of overlap among them all, which gets back to this thing of we have these very discrete ideas of what constitutes a vampire, what constitutes a werewolf, and what constitutes sort of the fictional witch, the malicious witch, right, that we have in fairy tales, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But when you actually start going into some of these stories, there's a lot of overlap. The things that you would use to stop a vampire might be used to stop a witch or might be used to stop a werewolf. Vampires, we talked about turning into different things. There are accounts where vampires would turn into dogs, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there was one belief in this French belief in a type of werewolf where the dead body would come back to life, and it would consume its burial shroud or something like that, and ultimately it would sort of erupt from the ground as a wolf, so right there you have these two kind of these two different things. You have this werewolf, you have this human turning into a werewolf, but you also have the undead element. So there was a lot of different overlap and interplay between these sort of legendary creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, do you think that if it weren't for Bram Stoker writing Dracula, that the notion of vampires would not have been as widespread, and most people might not have ever even heard of them?
I think. Bram Stoker's, importance to the popularization of the vampire, of, Dracula, the vampire as we know it, probably can't be overstated. The various interpretations and the impact of that novel. There were some popular works before Stoker that certainly had some popularity, at times, but I'm not sure if Stoker hadn't come along, would one of the other works kind of lasted or something like that? I'm not sure. Or would vampires be around in a different way? I'm sort of hard pressed to think up a 19th century like werewolf novel or something. But we still have werewolves, so I don't know if we would. We might still have vampires, but they might not have be the same way. Stoker introduced or popularized a lot of different things that we sort of take for granted now about vampires. So his shadow looms large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And then, we all think about vampires as coming from Transylvania or parts of Europe in general. I might be out of the loop, but I've never heard of a fictional vampire in classic movies ever speak with an American accent. Did you run into much information coming from here in North America?
Well, you know, there were vampire beliefs in various countries and various parts of the world in folklore. So, you know, obviously we think of you know, Transylvania, Transylvania is now part of Romania, Eastern Europe, and definitely it's highly present there. But, you know, I found stories, you know, you can widen the circle. You know, Germany, Russia, Poland, Greece had a very strong vampire tradition, where the vampire is known as the Vrykulakis in Greece. I found stories from China, India, Scandinavia, you know, the UK. And then, of course, you know, in America, like I mentioned earlier, like in New England, there were these accounts of vampires. So I think with the Transylvania connection, I think that's when we can very much thank Bram Stoker for, because that's where Count Dracula's from. And just because of the impact of that book, now they've sort of been sort of tied together, and there's no severing that connection, I think, at this point. But the Transylvania or Romania, they definitely don't have the monopoly on vampires in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember ever, you know, hearing stories and stuff about American vampires until, you know, fiction took over, Hollywood took over, and you start watching those movies. And, you know, somebody earlier left a message, to private message, and said, well, when did vampires become sparkly, sexy, and waxing their hair off? You know, it kind of goes along with the modern times. And I mean, it's fine. True Blood and all those other shows that have vampires on, now the vampires are hot, they're sexy, they're young, they're, you know, models almost,
right,
you know,
right.
You don't find.
And they don't, and they don't die.
And they don't die. Exactly.
Right. I mean, it's talking to us, right? Oh, I want to be young and attractive forever. I mean, it's so tapping into sort of this, you know, sort of the modern fears and the modern desires, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's amazing. So we just have a couple of minutes left, but I'm wondering about your take on modern people who claim to be vampires and drink blood. I mean, I'm sure you've heard people talk about that. And
sure. Yeah, I have run across that. The real life vampires, or the vampire movement, and that kind of thing. I know there's some people that they like the aesthetic of the vampire, while there's other people who feel that they need to consume blood, or sometimes you hear about like the psychic vampires, they need psychic energy, that kind of thing.
Plenty of them.
Yeah, I know, right? That's something I encountered from time to time in my research, but that was not my research focus.
Right.
So it's not something I dove into to any great extent. I think it's interesting that that there's that kind of movement out there, that culture, but it's not something that I don't have any firsthand experience with it. So I don't know. But you know, it's I mean, I like vampires. It's I get why you'd be drawn to them.
Well, and there is a medical condition which escapes me right now, that people certainly need. They do drink blood. I mean, and it's kind of like a necessary thing. I don't suppose, you know, the doctor would give you a prescription to a blood bank, but there's something lacking in their makeup that they crave it. They need it. I mean, you know, so there's a medicinal part of it, and then there's the part of some people just do it to jump on the bandwagon, you know, like people like to be, well, look at me, I'm a vampire, I'm a witch, I'm a werewolf. You know, people like that. So you can be anything you want to be. You just open your mouth and you can. But it's kind of an interesting concept that, you know, the sparkles, the TV shows, the young thing, and living forever. I mean, I think Interview with a Vampire was, like, I guess the first modern movie that most people probably watched or lots of people read Anne Rice's books anyway.
Very popular, yeah.
Yeah, and then it started getting a little bit more and more when it hit cable and TV and sparkly and wonderful and, you know, let's be a vampire. Oh, look, yeah. So it's kind of an amazing topic.
It's
an amazing topic to read about. It's an amazing topic to write about. And I really enjoyed the book. I mean, I didn't even realize that witches had so much in common with, you know, werewolves and vampires. Bad me. You know, I didn't do my own homework. But it was really interesting. So, I mean, it was a fun book. It was an interesting book. And I think people will enjoy it. And like I said, visually, it's amazing. It makes you, it's got the gothic look. And that's never a bad thing. So tell people where they can find out more about you and the book and you know, if you're doing any events or lectures or whatever.
Sure. So, the book is called Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. It's by me, A.P. Sylvia. You can find it on various online retailers such as Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Target.com. If your local bookstore doesn't have it, I suppose you could always ask, see if they could get it in for you. Mm-hmm. I have a blog called locationsoflore.com. In that I do posts about some of the interesting or spooky places I've visited. There's a number of vampire posts in there about some of the different sites I've gone to. So you can see some pictures of that, and I talk about it. Off that site, you can find links for my Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And so if I'm doing anything, if I'm going to be anywhere or be on any shows or something like that, I'll be posting it on social media. So you can follow me there.
You're easy to find. Some people aren't. And so, well, I really want to thank you again for being and sharing the book, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was fun and fun and informational. Two things are really kind of cool when you mix them together, because you learn and you enjoy it at the same time. So thank you, and feel free to come back anytime.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you enjoyed the book, and I really enjoyed chatting with you tonight, and I'd love to come back.
Good. Well, we'll make that happen. And I want to thank everybody else who's listening to the show as well, both live and on the podcast. And don't forget to go over to and subscribe at the show's YouTube channel. Just type in Stirring the Cauldron Para X, and you'll find it easy enough. And if you want to know what's around my website and find out more about the show and all kinds of things, you can go to marlabrooks.com. So until next time, everybody, as usual, blessed be, and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2019. The Mysterioso March by Kevin MacLeod is licensed through Incompotech.com.